Should the media be objective and unbiased? Is that even possible? Or does open partisanship in media actually produce some good results? I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Kathleen Dunn. It's 7 minutes after nine here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Now, our discussion this hour was prompted by news of a study that found that people who are disengaged from a political issue were more likely to get involved after hearing from partisan media on the topic. This was a pretty small study, not the be-all and end-all of journalism studies, but we thought it was a good conversation starter. And we called Bob McChesney to talk about ideas of objectivity and bias in the media. He's a professor of communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, host of Media Matters at Illinois Public Media. His books include Rich Media, Poor Democracy, and Will the Last Reporter Please Turn Out the Lights, The Collapse of Journalism, and What Can Be Done to Fix It. Bob McChesney, welcome to the show.
Hey, my pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start with the media landscape today. We've seen an explosion of partisan media, from blogs to cable TV and many other points along the spectrum. How much has this changed our media landscape?
Well, it certainly has changed it dramatically. And I think that specifically there are two factors that are sort of key to this that aren't mentioned in the first sentence. One is we've also seen a decline in resources going to traditional reporting, a fairly sharp decline. On a per capita basis, there are probably roughly half the number of working reporters and editors today that there were, say, 20, 25 years ago, maybe even a lot less than that, depending on the community. So there's a lot less people actually reporting, covering, gathering news than there used to be. And in that void, much less expensive pontificating is a commercial option, and it's easier for people to participate with as amateurs. The second key point is that the political right wing in this country, most notably Fox News, under Rupert Murdoch's leadership and Roger Ailes, have really pushed the agenda on partisanship in a manner that hasn't been seen in the United States for, you know, a century.
Now, this partisan media isn't really a new invention, is it? If you look back earlier in American history, you see newspapers very closely affiliated with political parties are taking strong points of view. I've read some, you know, mid-1910s newspapers really pushing the Theodore Roosevelt point of view and calling Woodrow Wilson a wimp for not getting involved in Europe. This is nothing new, right?
Well, in fact, you understate the situation, to be frank. The notion of objective, neutral, unopinionated journalism, the idea that this is what a free press is all about or democratic journalism, is a very recent invention. It would have been unthinkable until maybe 100 years ago, approximately. During the first, 10 generations of American history, at the founding throughout the 19th century, journalism was understood as primarily and explicitly a partisan exercise, that it was all newspapers were connected to political parties or factions of parties. They had an explicit viewpoint. In 1892, for example, if you were in a community that had a Democratic newspaper, it's possible you could go through the entire presidential election and never see the Republican candidate mentioned in a Democratic paper or the Democratic candidate mentioned in a Republican paper. This was our whole history of journalism in this country is bathed in intense partisanship.
Was that necessarily a bad thing?
No, and I think that's what this study that we're basing the show on gets at. Partisan journalism, per se, is not a bad thing. It actually has many great benefits. This is why Jefferson and Adams and our founders, our framers, or the abolitionists, all of them were big proponents of it. And the great advantage of partisan journalism, opinionated journalism, is that it does draw people into public life. If an issue comes along, slavery, tariffs, today health care, any issue that you think is important, the economy, partisan journalism tries to put it in some sort of moral, ethical, historical context so you can make sense of it and why it's important. And that draws people into public life. They see the value and importance of an issue and where it fits into everything else. There's sort of a story that goes with it. Whereas a journalism that tries to cut off all those links can seem dry, antiseptic, boring, uninteresting to many people and sort of turn them off to politics, which is the core of what this argument is. Our journalism in the 19th century did a tremendous job of drawing people into public life. And it wasn't the only factor, but our voting turnout rates were vastly higher than across all social classes among eligible voters in the 19th century. The key, though, to making partisanship partisan journalism work well, the ultimate key is that you've got to have a wide range of opinions, and it's got to be relatively easy for diverse and dissenting views to be heard. And if you don't have that, then partisan journalism can start to smell and stink, sort of what you get in authoritarian societies.
Rob Ferret talking to Bob McChesney. He's a communications professor, a longtime journalism watchdog. We're talking about the value of partisan media, or the downside of partisan media, for that matter, whether we need a strong investigative journalism model out there. What do you think? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Bob McChesney, you mentioned the lack of balance. Maybe you see one side not getting their voices out there. We have this exploded media landscape where anybody can start a blog, tweet, that sort of thing. Everybody can get their opinions out there, right? We all have that opportunity.
Yeah, we all have that opportunity, but only a handful have an opportunity to have an audience of any substance. And what we see now with the internet, the evidence is now in pretty clearly, and it has tremendous benefits, which I've written about and which I think many of the listeners are familiar with. But the original claim, the claim of, say, 10 years ago when the blogosphere was exploding, just sort of what you summed up there, which is that it was going to lead to a plethora of everyone having a chance to participate as an active journalist and get in there and influence the news culture. I think the evidence is in now that that's not happening, that there is, you know, a limit to human capacity for how many websites we can go to. And there's been a phenomenal sort of winnowing process. So there's actually, in terms of page views, there's more concentration online in the digital news world and the digital public affairs and public political world than there is in the offline world. You know, a handful of websites and services completely dominate it. And so the idea that just someone sitting in their underpants in their basement can effectively get on there and participate with a corporate news media is simply not, doesn't cut it. They can't have that right to do so, but they also have the right to, you know, jump around in the nude in their house and no one cares.
So who are the sites you mentioned that are getting all these hits?
Well, they're actually, if you look at the top sites, the list, and they're done, you know, someone can go online and check the rating services, but it's usually basically the same sites you see on cable TV and traditional news media, which makes perfect sense. Because if I want to know what's going on in some economic crisis or some political issue, I want to go to a website that actually has a reporter that might be covering it. So I'm going to be inclined to go to NPR, for example, that website, or the New York Times, or CNN, or the Guardian. There's any number. I'm unlikely to want to go to Fred Schmoe's blog from Des Moines, Iowa, because, you know, Fred has some ideas about something, but when he gets off work.
And you make the case that the right has a disproportionate balance of the media, of the partisan media, anyway.
Well, this is a complex issue. And, you know, what happened was the political right in this country, going back really to the 1970s, what we call the political right, and that's another issue altogether, what's become understood as the political right in this country, which was, you know, has significant differences from what it had been in previous generations. But what we've come to know today is the political right. Starting in the 1970s, began to aggressively view traditional, what we call professional journalism, with an effort to be neutral and balanced, as a main barrier to their political success. They saw that journalism as basically being biased towards Democrats and liberals and harming them. And they said, we've got to take on that media machine if we're going to achieve political success in this country. It's been a big part of the right-wing political agenda since the 70s. And I think for the 70s and 80s, the primary way it manifests itself is through criticism of traditional journalism, the liberal media elite, blasting them, criticizing them, jawboning them, trying to make commercial news media and public news media more sympathetic to the right, giving them larger play, treating them more generously, treating their issues more generously. And I think it had considerable effect and influence for the right. But the dramatic move came first with talk radio in the late 80s and early 90s with the likes of Rush Limbaugh, but especially Fox News in the mid-1990s. And this was a different type of partisan media from what we had throughout American history. You know, if you went to Philadelphia in 1840 or 1870 or Chicago or Chicago in 1870 or Boston or New York, you would have had a partisan media where you would have had 10 or 12 or 15 competing independently owned daily newspapers, each with a political viewpoint, each connected to a party. And there would have been a pretty broad range to pick from. And papers came and went. It was a competitive market. And each of those 15 papers was vying to expand its readership. So it wasn't just throwing red meat to the choir. It was actually trying to appeal to people outside its narrow range, which is a real truth check on a partisan media when you have competition. What Fox came in to do and what the Limbaugh do was rather say, look, the entire mainstream media is ideologically biased against us. So we don't have to play by their rules because just by advocating our position, we're providing the necessary balance. And we don't have to really follow the traditional standards for truth and accuracy, not to mention story selection. And it's sort of they didn't play by the same rules, and it gave the right-wing media, especially Fox, the ability to drive the news agenda. So if they started covering a story that no one else was covering and pushing it, it sort of forced the other media to fall into line or be accused of liberal bias. You know, every day you almost can see a story that fits this example, one that jumps out, say the Shirley Sherrod story, that poor woman who got fired because a speech she gave was edited to make her sound like a racist when the speech was the exact opposite. Well, Fox played that story on an endless loop until basically the poor woman quit. And other news media picked it up, too. And now, 30 years ago, that wouldn't have happened.
We'll talk more about the partisan media in particular, but let's tackle the idea of objective, balanced media. Is it possible for the mainstream media to be objective?
No, it's absurd, and I think everyone knows that, which is why most journalists don't use the term objective. That's not a commonly embraced term. The idea that a reporter or a news medium can go out and cover the social world of human beings in a way like a mathematician would add up a row of numbers and all mathematicians would agree that 4 plus 7 equals 11, you cannot cover the world that way. That's absurd. Now, that doesn't mean you can't have better, more accurate, more fair journalism than other types of journalism. And I think the more accurate concern and the claim has to be whether you can have a journalism that is more factually accurate, balanced, fair, drawing people into public life and giving them the resources to participate, have an honest understanding of what's going on. So fairness and accuracy become the hallmarks, as opposed to sort of a notion of objectivity, which is objectivity is always in the eye of the beholder to a certain extent. What looks objective to Sheldon Adelson doesn't look objective to an unemployed worker in Racine.
Well, with the idea of balance, a common complaint I see is for people critical of what they call he said, she said journalism. Now, well, here's our story. The Democrats say this, the Republicans say that. Story's done now. Do you think that's a problem?
Absolutely. It's a central problem. It's one of the great crises. And I think when we look at the history of professional journalism, which I prefer to use to objective because it's a more accurate description of what historically has taken place and where we are now, professional journalism arose roughly a century ago. And it came into place by the early 20th century when newspaper markets, which are the primary news medium at that time, became increasingly concentrated in small town after small town. The economics of newspapering whittled down to one or maybe two papers, even in the largest cities, where once in the 19th century you might have 10, 20, 25, 30 daily newspapers competing in the largest cities. And even in cities like Milwaukee 125 years ago, you might have 10 or 12 or 15 dailies. And all these cities are whittling down to one or two or three papers, and it becomes impossible or virtually impossible to start new newspapers. It's not an open market. It's not competitive any longer. In this context, highly partisan journalism, where the newspaper took a strong position, became very bad business because it basically was antagonizing a big part of the market suddenly you had access to and control over. And that gave a tremendous commercial spur for owners of newspapers and media to sort of tamp down, cool off on the partisanship, and come up with something that would replace it that would not antagonize their monopoly markets in many cases. There were other factors, too, like the rise of the Telegraph, the Associated Press, which meant one news story had to appeal to every possible constituency around the country coming off the wire services. But primarily it was driven by this monopolization and the commercial needs of owners. But then once you come up with the idea that you're going to have a separate journalism independent of the owner, so you won't know the political values of the owners when you pick up the front page of a paper, which became sort of between 1900 and 1920, that was the process we went through. That still doesn't answer the question of, well, what does that mean? What is professional journalism going to be? And this is when we had a great fight in America over how to define what professional journalism should be, between the newspaper owners, the magnates, on one hand, and between the union of print reporters, the newspaper guild, and newsrooms around the country. And it really hit the fan, so to speak, in the 1930s. On one side, you had the newspaper guild led by people like I.F. Stone and Haywood Broun, some of the most famous journalists in our history, who argued that the newsroom had to be the domain of journalists who would control it, basically. The owners and advertisers would have no say, and that they would pick the stories, and their attitude would be to be critical of everyone in power, and they'd work on behalf of everyone outside of power, and they'd have the same standard for everyone who had power. That type of journalism was not attractive to newspaper magnates who didn't want to sacrifice any control over their newsroom and also didn't want a journalism that was going to be way too critical of themselves, their friends, their cronies, and business and in government. Instead, we ended up with a type of professional journalism that you started the question with, which was one that was much more tepid. And it basically said the range of legitimate debate on news stories is determined by what people in power are debating. And if they're debating something, we'll present both sides of legitimate debate. And if they're not debating something, we won't question it. And it basically gave a very small C conservative status quo bias, official sort of news bias to much of what professional journalism is. And that's the criticism people have. So if there's a debate on an issue in Washington today, say whether we're going to invade this country or that country, the range of debate goes between the Republican and Democratic leadership. If they're in agreement, our news media treats it as if it's a given and it's natural, it's just fine. They aren't going to look for dissenting voices outside of elites. And if they're debating something, then we get entitled to have sort of a he said, she said. And then that built into it, as your question said, Rob, is that there's real problems with that. That means you don't really have a critical journalism. It represents people in power. And accuracy is just accurately reflecting what they tell us. But if they're lying to us, journalists are very hesitant to say they're lying because they don't want to antagonize their crucial sources and be called partisan and be called unprofessional. So it becomes a situation in which people in power can get away with saying outrageous things and never being held accountable.
And do you have examples? Was there a heyday of journalism's actually stepping outside that role, challenging the powerful, regardless of the risk and regardless of losing contact with their sources?
Well, I think there's not a heyday of where our institutions in the last 100 years have done that, but there are a number of journalists, sterling journalists, who just jump out. I.F. Stone, the most famous, and I.F. Stone broke story after story. The legendary journalist in the middle third of the 20th century broke story after story basically by just not having any contact with people in power. He didn't want to socialize with them. He didn't want to hang out with them. He didn't want to interview them. He just looked at government documents and researched them. And he broke story after story just by doing hard digging and not really worrying about whether he antagonized people in power. He had that traditional view that journalism should be critical of everyone in power on behalf of everyone outside of power. Today we see that type of journalism in someone like Glenn Greenwald at Salon.com, who's about to join The Guardian. Glenn Greenwald was very critical of the Bush administration for its foreign policy, its record in civil liberties. And you could read his column, seems very sympathetic to Obama before the 2008 election. But he's held President Obama to the exact same standard. And that's what a great journalism should do. It should have one standard for everyone.
That's Bob McChesney. He's a professor of journalism at the University of Urbana-Champaign. A bunch of books by him or co-authored by him, including Please Turn Out the Lights, The Collapse of Journalism and What Can Be Done to Fix It. We'll get to your calls coming up at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. What do you think about balance in the media, about partisan media, and the positive or negative role you see it playing? 800-642-1234. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Kathleen Dunn this week. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret, filling in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 11, Larry Mueller will talk about Wisconsin's agricultural history. His guest has some interesting and unique anecdotes. The author of Wisconsin Farm Lore, Kicking Cows, Giant Pumpkins, and Other Tales from the Back 40. This hour, I'm talking about Bob McChesney, about the media landscape, bias, balance, ideas of objectivity, and the value or the negative side of partisan media. We'll get to your calls now. Joe in Johnson Creek will start us off. Hi, Joe.
Hi, good morning. Bob, I appreciate your discussion on this today and your taking on this topic. I don't think it's talked about enough. At least honestly. So let me give you three quick bullets and see if you can reply to three of them. Number one, partisanship sells. So I believe that, you know, it's because people love a villain. So you see it especially on talk radio, on Fox, and not that the left doesn't do this. You make a villain and you attack them, and then people jump on the bandwagon. Number two would be the reason I found it interesting that you mentioned that, you know, so openly that media is can't be objective. And I think why media people wouldn't want to admit that, and they know it, because humans just, we're biased, you know. But it's all about the degree of severity, how biased are you. And once again, talk radio and on the right, they exaggerate so many things, as they do, and they exaggerate the level of bias. So I think that because this term bias and liberal bias, and these people with their bumper stickers, I don't believe the liberal bias, the liberal media, you know, they're creating this notion that they're so severely biased when the stuff they're listening to is just as biased. So that's what's ridiculous. So, and then number three finally would be, there's a downside to this upside that you mentioned, and I was intrigued. I had to call in because I never realized that there's an upside to partisanship in that, yeah, that they focus in like a laser on their enemy so good that I always say you should listen to the commentators of the opposite party in power. If Obama's in power, listen to Rush Limbaugh a little bit, see what dirt he's digging up, because maybe the left ain't going to tell you. If get into the scandal as deep and highlight some of the issues.
Gotcha. There's a lot to talk about there, Joe, and other folks waiting on the line, so I want to get a response from Bob McChesney. Where should we start with?
I took some notes there on the first two points. Let me talk about those. Yeah, the partisanship sells, and that's absolutely right. I think that the structural reason why we see MSNBC and Fox doing what they're doing is that if you're going to strip down newsrooms, so you have far fewer reporters actually doing covering stories, breaking stories, doing investigative work, and then you go on the air and you just try to present a bland news, unopinionated, nonpartisan news story, well, no one's going to watch you because you have no value added. And I think the genius of Fox News, what it understood, is if you stop doing actual reporting, which they do very little of, and just have pontificating and partisanship, then that can be your value added. That's a very lucrative way to make money, because it's a lot cheaper to put a few celebrity people like Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly on the screen for an hour than it is to have a newsroom of 1,000 reporters covering the world. And so it's driven by commercial interest. And that's true at the MSNBC side, too. They realize, too, hey, we don't have the reporters to do a full-service great journalism, or what we would consider great journalism. It's a lot cheaper just to get talented people who would have a liberal viewpoint and appeal to that market segment. The second point, and this is a crucial point we have to talk about, which is that partisanship is not a bad thing at all in a certain context, and it's very, very healthy. For example, all scholarship, without exception, everywhere in the world, all scholarship is partisan. Everything I write is partisan. I have a viewpoint. We expect scholars to have an argument based on the evidence. But what we also expect of scholars is we expect them to deal with evidence that contradicts their argument. That's a sign of a credible scholar. Someone who says, okay, this is what I'm arguing, but here's all the evidence that has been mounted by other scholars against what I'm saying. I'm going to assess it, and I'm going to tell you why it doesn't matter. And then you understand you're getting a partisan viewpoint, but you're getting someone who's a serious scholar. And that approach is what great partisan journalism should do. It's okay to have a viewpoint, but you've got to establish that you're going to take the arguments that go against your claims, and you're going to assess them honestly, and you're going to adjust your argument if the evidence is so strong that you can't counter it. And I think that's what's missing in the sort of what we call partisanship today. It's a joke. Today, it's completely unaccountable. It's just in the case of Fox, it's Republican Party talking points, and there's absolutely no accountability, or frankly, there's very little concern for factual accuracy. And that sort of partisanship is what you expect in societies with not very well functioning democratic systems. So I'll stop there and go back to the phone lines.
Well, but the critique from the right of the mainstream media, I think, is that you've got almost a groupthink of a bunch of people with unexamined biases, not examining each other's biases because they think roughly the same way, the same kind of people go into journalism, into the media, and as an aggregate, they tend to be more liberal than the population as a whole, and that's why they say the mainstream media has this unself-questioning bias. Is there something to that?
There is and there isn't. Most working journalists probably traditionally have come from what would be considered more socially liberal backgrounds. But the research shows that the farther one goes up the pecking order of journalism, and this is not just true recently, but historically. The more one is likely to run into people who are very have traditional upper their class position on economic issues and foreign policy. So the top people, the editors and reporters at the highest levels, tend to be very much comfortable with the status quo. But the crucial point here is that working journalists don't control newsrooms. They lost that battle in the 1930s and 1940s. The values that permeate the news that are really the crisis, like the one we talked about earlier, Rob, where the reliance on basically official sources to set the legitimate terms of debate, that wasn't determined by liberal journalists. That was determined by the type of professionalism that was copacetic with the commercial system of publishing. So that's why when the Gulf War came along or the Iraq War in 2002-2003, why we were inundated with expert opinion confirming over and over again that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction in our traditional news media, not right-wing media, mind you. I mean, whatever they were doing, they might have been pumping it up too. But this, we're talking New York Times and NPR, the works, was that they were depending upon Democratic officials and Republican officials, both who all were saying this was the case. There just weren't dubious, doubting voices at the top of the mainstream. That has nothing to do with liberal bias. That's the real bias. It's just towards power.
Talking to Bob McChesney about media balance, partisan media, and more. In a little bit, I'll ask about what we can do to fix the media or what might improve the way our media works. But back to the phones now with Boyd in Milwaukee.
Good morning, Rob, and good morning, Mr. McChesney. Always a pleasure to hear you. And, Rob, you're doing a great job.
Thanks.
My question is this. I think the fundamental problem, and this may have already been addressed to a degree, is just the amount of sensationalism. And I think this, I thought Bob brought up a good point where maybe this isn't really anything new. It can go back as far as the 1800s. But I think when you fast forward it to modern times, I think a lot of it started a little bit before I was born. There was a show in the mid-1960s hosted by a guy named Joe Pyne who would have these fringe guests on. And then you found it influenced in the 80s people like Wally George and Morton Downey, which I think actually influenced not only AM talk radio, but shows like the Jerry Springer Show, which in turn brought about Fox. I think, a show like Joe Pyne and maybe even Wally George, I think they were kind of like fringe shows. It's like, yeah, you see them, you might even get a few chuckles, but you really shouldn't take them seriously. Now I think the fringe has become the mainstream, and to bring this full circle, I think it has led to the dumbing down of our country, which to me is really quite alarming.
Bob McChesney?
Boyd makes some good points, and I'm glad he mentioned Joe Pyne. I used to watch that as a teenager in Cleveland, Ohio in the 60s.
And I used to watch Morton Downey, I remember, back in the 80s.
So, yeah, those are shows they really are predecessors to what we see today in many respects. And I would just add two points to that. One, if you're in an environment where you don't have resources to actually cover news and break stories, doing what Joe Pyne did, doing what Morton Downey did, doing what Fox does and Rush Limbaugh does, and doing basically to a large extent what MSNBC does, makes perfect sense. The value added is basically inexpensive pontificating, and that is what you do. You don't have the resources to do journalism. And the other point is sensationalism, and this is a big part of it. The sort of ratcheting up of sort of gotcha journalism and what seems like absurd news stories. This is very much driven by commercial factors, just like Boyd was saying. And one test of this is just cruise the dial between what you'd hear on a community or public station in terms of news coverage and what you'll see on cable TV or in a commercial newscast. And you'll see far fewer stories about celebrities, sort of scandals here. You'll see some than you would there. And that's all commercially driven. That's inexpensive way to do journalism and to get an audience and to give the illusion of tension and conflict, but no substance of tension and conflict in a meaningful sense.
How did 24-hour cable news change the way we think of news? Because sometimes there's 24 hours worth of news to talk about big policy issues or breaking news, and sometimes there's a picture of a bear in somebody's backyard, and they run tape of that for 5-10 minutes at a time. How did that change things for us?
Well, it's changed it in a lot of ways. I think the most important way, or one of the most important ways, is that the notion of when the morning paper comes or the evening newscast comes, you stop everything to get it because that's your news infusion, has ended, thanks to both 24-hour cable news, but also the internet. Now, you know, you basically, if you want news, you get it on demand somewhere. Now, it's largely going to be from the same sources you were getting your newspaper or TV news from, probably, or significantly, but you're not waiting for it. And so that's really upset, been part of upsetting the entire notion of news media. Now, the idea that there's just not enough material to fill the day, that's again an economic question. There's not enough material to fill a day because you don't have the resources to fill the day necessarily. This probably is, you could fill the time some one way or another with meaningful material, but if you had the resources.
Thanks for the call, Boyd. Daryl in Bloomington is next. Hi, Daryl.
Yeah, hi. Yes, Robert, you should have a weekly show on public television.
Well, actually, I have one on public radio in Illinois.
Yeah, I just found that out last night, and I wish I would have been able to follow you all these years. But media is a sleeping giant, and it has unlimited potential to solve our major economic problems. Media is supposed to ferret out the true realities that exist within our world and not try to deal with this fair and balanced deal when you're concerning. It's nothing but political opinions anyway, and half of it's falsehoods and so forth, propaganda. But all media should, of course, be apolitical. There are no usable idea contents in most of our media. It's political battles back and forth, and there are major ideas that can solve our economic problems, our energy problems, and all these various problems, but you can't get it to the public. Now, I have a website.
I'm going to cut you off, Daryl, there. You've given us probably five or six things to talk about there. One of them was, I think he didn't use this phrase, but actionable intelligence. Does our media, Bob McChesney, give us information we need to make informed decisions about our politics, about our government and economy?
As a rule, no. The media don't. I think the media, the news media, the way they are structured to operate is that they report on what people in power are debating. So in the debate on health care, for example, to pick a recent example we all lived with, the range of debate that our news media took seriously was that of the Obama administration on one side and the criticism of the Republican Party on the other side. Now, one might say, why not look at most other industrial democracies in the world and see how they do it and posit that as sort of the standard that should be central to our debate? And I think the perfect example of this is Britain, which is, anyone watched the Olympic opening ceremony, saw this astonishing 11-minute salute to nationalized medicine in the Olympic opening ceremony, the National Health Service. Astonishing, because it's so embraced that no conservative would dare touch it in that country, including Margaret Thatcher, or criticize it. That's something, you know, why credible journalism, why not offer that as a plan that we ought to be weighing here? Well, in this country, if a journalist had dared to suggest that Margaret Thatcher's National Health Service or the Canadian service was a legitimate option and ought to be debated by the Republican and Democratic leaders, they would have been dismissed as an ideological hack, as someone who's trying to interject their own opinions. And we weren't just reporting, they were trying to be players. That would have been completely unacceptable and a career killer. So we don't get it. The system isn't really structured for journalists to bring in expert opinion unless there's someone in power sort of advocating that position. Then they have sort of a front to do so, a cover to do so.
Daryl also brought up ferreting out the truth, an issue of great importance to me. We'll talk about that coming up after the break. You can join in this discussion on journalism, balance, bias, objectivity, if that's an idea people want to make a case for. 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call. 800-642-1234. You can email, by the way, at talk@WPR.org or post on the Kathleen Dunn Facebook page. More to come. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret, filling in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 10, fairy tales. Why do we tell them? Why do we watch movies about them? How have they changed since the dawn of time? Once Upon a Time, coming up after 10. This hour, talking to Bob McChesney about the state of American media and journalism. Lots of interesting issues about partisanship, bias. And Bob, something you brought up toward the beginning of the hour, one of the core problems I know you've talked about, the decline of investigative journalism. And I want to talk about your ideas for solutions. What can we do to see more investigative journalism? And as our last caller, Daryl, mentioned, getting back to ferreting out the facts.
Well, investigative journalism is really a relatively new part of journalism. You know, the idea of journalism in the United States for much of the 19th century wasn't investigative. It was political journalism. You covered politics, but there wasn't the idea that you wanted to do a lot of digging behind the scenes. That emerged over time and became really the hallmark of the 20th century journalism, was the idea of doing investigative work, going in and covering what people in power are doing, what they're trying to keep secret, especially in the crucial part of investigative journalism, was what powerful private interests and government interests are doing in cahoots with each other, the heart of corruption. And that's the sort of journalism, if you just cover press conferences and you just cover the what goes on in a Senate chamber or an assembly chamber, you're never going to get. That requires actually doing proactive work. It's very expensive. It takes months to do oftentimes. And at its best, it's the greatest journalism this system can produce. Now, investigative journalism has a real problem in our current commercial news media system. One, it's very expensive, so it's the sort of thing that owners quickly cut. And so we've seen a real reduction in the amount of resources going to investigative journalism over the last 25 years. I mean, a dramatic cut. And what we end up now with, what passes for investigative journalism increasingly, far too much for a sane society, is when someone in government leaks a report now, a news media will, whoever gets that leaked report, will present it like they've done some hardcore investigative work. All they're doing is someone in power wanted to leak something, or someone in government did, and they're just reporting it, and they call that an investigative study. The other problem with investigative of journalism for the sort of commercial system is, if it's really done right, it's going to get after people in power, and that's going to be very controversial and not really good for the bottom line. So our current system isn't too excited about investigative journalism, but we desperately need it. So, you know, your question then, Rob, is how do we solve the problem? How do we get it? And I think that's one of the great issues we got to be talking about. How do we not just get investigative, but all types of journalism? John Nichols and I, in our book, The Death and Life of American Journalism, visited this question, wrote a whole book about it 2 years ago. And we argue that there has to be a way to have public funding to set up independent, competitive, autonomous news media that will have the funding to do great work, but will not have any control over what they do by the government. And we argue that was actually the American way, that in American history, for the first century, that partisan press we talked about was heavily subsidized by the government through extremely inexpensive postal rates, did all the distribution of newspapers for the first 50 years of American history, and through printing contracts. The founders and the framers of this country understood you had to subsidize journalism, and you couldn't allow the government to censor it. But if you didn't have a subsidy, there wouldn't be any journalism in the first place, and you couldn't have a republic. I think it's pretty clear the market has failed. If we're going to sit around and hope for Madison Avenue and Wall Street to provide us the resources for journalism we're dreaming, we have to come up with structural solutions.
Rob Ferret talking to Bob McChesney about journalism and what he sees wrong with it and what could fix it. You can join in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Is there a source you go to for investigative journalism, or do you check out partisan media from all perspectives? 800-642-1234. Scott in Peshtigo is with us now. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. Yeah, I'm wondering where the bias comes from. I'm wondering if it goes all the way back to J school. I mean, I'm not saying there's this vast left-wing conspiracy, but there seems to be, when it comes to journalism and the news, what I would consider a liberal sensibility, you might say. You know, the thing that happened at CNN just 2 days ago, you know, they played the bumper music, the stupid girl, when they're about to do a Sarah Palin story, and try to say, "Well, that was an accident." You know, I mean, it goes to even to you know, engineers and production managers and things, where I think people have a liberal sensibility. I mean, I listen, I follow all different media. I love to watch it, and I love to listen to left and right. I mean, Wisconsin Public Radio is a perfect example. A lot of times, you guys do a show in the morning. You'll have two opinions: somebody in the first half hour, somebody in the second half hour. 11 out of the last 13, the liberal view has been on the second half hour to rebut the first half hour. Now, is that coincidence, or did somebody determine, you know what, we'll put this opinion on in the second half? I just, you know, sites like, you know, Media Research Center, what I really love about media is you can actually go in and actually see video clips. It's great where you can go to MRC and you can see Dan Rather and Matt Lauer and Katie Couric and actually see videotape of what they say in the context, and you go, maybe there is a bit of a liberal sensibility when it comes to how the news is portrayed.
Gotcha. Thanks for the call, Scott. I'll have to go back and check our half and halves and make sure we're we're doing them half and half in the right direction. But Scott's more general point, and I'd kind of touched on this earlier, Bob, this sort of internalized liberal unquestioned bias in mainstream media.
And it's all based, as Scott pointed out and as you did earlier, on the idea that sort of people who become journalists are biased towards their liberal values. So that's going to be their comfort zone to naturally assume a liberal position. And there's an element of truth to that, but it's a very small element for all the reasons we talked about in the show. For one thing, what's conspicuously missing in that analysis is the corporations that own news media, the advertisers that support it, and the role the people who actually control the checkbook play in determining news. And it's ironic that the emphasis on the values of journalists being determinative of what journalism is coming in a moment where very few journalists left due to commercial pressures. You know, I think the research shows that if you define the political range of debate as this very narrow sort of far left as Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, way over to wherever the Republican Party is the right, and then say, well, journalists look like they sort of favor that sort of Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama opinion on balance if you look really closely. To me, that misses something a lot more important. Like, you know, where is national health care in the debate? Why is that ignored? And because Hillary Clinton isn't talking about that, so we don't get that, I guess. There are bigger fish to fry for us, what our journalism is missing. In the Gulf War or the invasion of Iraq, we're getting the range of elite opinion. And this argument basically says journalists will tend towards the liberal fringe or half of elite opinion, but it's still very much, by all accounts, steadfastly elite opinion. And when elite opinion marches in lockstep, like they did in the Iraq War in 2002, 2003, then, you know, we all lose. And it's not really a left-right issue. It's this issue of getting a full range of debate and getting the truth out there.
Back to the phones now at 800-642-1234. Annalisa is on the line in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. Well, I have a couple of things. One thing is this whole idea of journalists socializing with the people in power and that corrupting the journalism, or their objectivity, certainly. I just want your opinion about that. But I also wonder, in terms of people writing today, I mean, where do you put somebody like Seymour Hersh or some of the magazines like The Atlantic or Mother Jones? I mean, where do you put publications like that, and where do we look online for the kind of thing you're talking about?
Great question. And I think the first point, I mentioned this earlier with I.F. Stone. I mean, I.F. Stone refused to have social relationships with people in power because he knew if he wrote something critical about the Attorney General or the Secretary of State and his kids went to the same private school and he played croquet with them on weekends, it'd be a little harder for him to pull that trigger to write an accurate, fair story that the truth demanded. So he said, it's better for me not to have social relations with them. Well, the definition of being a Washington journalist today is having cozy relationships with people in power. So that's where you get your information. That's the sign of making it. And so fraught with that whole relationship is this insider bias that is deadly by I.F. Stone standards. And that's why, you know, going back to you, so who are the journalists today? Seymour Hersh, great journalist. And I think he's much closer to the I.F. Stone part of the spectrum than he is to the sort of inside beltway type journalist today. Glenn Greenwald, fantastic journalist. And interesting, Glenn Greenwald, who writes for Salon and is moving to The Guardian, works mostly out of Brazil, does much of his research online. He doesn't have direct personal relationships with the Secretary of State, yet he breaks stories. He comes up with material that no one inside the beltway with all the access in the world is coming up with, because they're not really going in the places that's going to antagonize people in power, asking tough questions about drone warfare, for example, or torture, that he's willing to ask because he's not eating lunch with these people.
Thanks for the call, Annalisa. Up next is Dave in Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Well, I wanted to address the fair and balanced thing, how it's undermined, you know, information for us when we have like, for instance, during the Bush years, the Republicans controlled all three houses, and the fair and balanced thing required the news service to talk just as much about Democrats as Republicans, even though Republicans were the ones running the entire show. And I wanted to get your guests' comments on how fair and balanced is anything but.
Well, fair and balanced is broken down by who's in power. So you're fair and balanced between the people who actually have lots of power. So if you're outside of power, you're not in the equation. You're not fair or you're not balanced. You're not part of it. And actually, what's interesting, in the years in which Democrats or Republicans have commanding control of Congress and or the White House, generally speaking, the research shows that on all the talk programs and use of sources, the party in power gets a much higher percentage of sort of the visiting slots on those Sunday morning shows and expert commentary. People in power tend to have a bias towards them, even though the party out of power does get a significant percentage. But no one else has a look in. Basically, what they're talking about is the legitimate range of debate. And again, I would argue that that's the real problem we have here. The problem isn't whether isn't just about one party versus the other. That is an issue and worth studying. But we have bigger problems, bigger fish to fry than I think the article we're doing this program on about the nature of journalism and drawing people into public life, it really gets at those issues.
Thanks for the call, Dave. Next is Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Something I said, I bided my time all this time, but then I listened to what a caller a couple of people ago mentioned, and it just sort of poked me in the eye, this notion of there being a liberal sensibility. And you turn on Fox News or any cable news program, I think, pretty much, except for maybe MSNBC, which has a distinctly and unapologetically liberal slant, you will never see a liberal guest on Fox News, ever. And there's always populated by the same group of characters who basically use it as a Republican platform, and they're very unapologetic about it. Well, except for the fact they call that fair and balanced, because they call mainstream media overwhelmed. It's like the Orwellian big lie. You tell the lie long enough and often enough and loud enough, people will start to accept it.
Gotcha. Bob McChesney, a response.
Well, look, partisan journalism, for it to really be a democratic system, requires that there be multiple players and that each of the players is structured in such a way that they've got to own up to their factual accuracy. And if they're screwing up and they're called on it by another partisan media, they make changes. And that's more or less the nature of partisan journalism in American history of the first 7,500 years of American history. I don't want to exaggerate it, but I have to be a little bit simplistic. But today we're in a situation in which most media claim to be neutral, but then one of them sort of blatantly partisan and makes no effort to be anything else. It gives us this sort of screwball period we're in now where it's very difficult to consume American news media that's given to us on cable TV and not just want to turn your television set off in disgust.
Thanks for the call. Jim in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. In the first place, I don't see that in the establishment that there's any far left at all in America. I certainly don't see Obama and Clinton as far left by any stretch of the imagination. And what we can expect from Fox News in terms of their views of minorities and women and gays is just so foul that you could almost say that they're not journalists, but they're actually croctologists. So I think the offset that we have to do is to find our own sources. We have to read magazines like Z and Mother Jones, and we also have to go to Amazon.com and pick up documentaries and donate these documentaries to schools and libraries so that we get some more progressive views on. For example, Monsignor by about Romero that just came out, and also things like that relate to the electronic vote fraud.
I'm gonna jump in, Jim, because we just have a couple minutes left. And Bob McChesney, I think Jim maybe takes us to a good place. What can American citizens or media consumers, if we want to think of them that way, what can we do about it?
Well, I think Jim's right. And I think for a significant percentage of Americans who are deeply concerned about politics and care about journalism, you know, seeking out alternatives, finding the people doing the good work, supporting them as much as you can is imperative. I, for one, you know, I'm a news junkie, and I'm finding it harder and harder to watch television news anymore because I just feel like I'm getting party talking points and nothing else, and I'm not learning anything that's really helping me understand the world. I'm just learning their spin. And so, yeah, going out and being proactive to find the good stuff. But I think we've got a big issue here, too, in the long term and medium term. We've got to produce more good material. Part of the problem we face cases, it's all, we're surrounded by garbage. We're surrounded by inexpensive, basically talking point propaganda that passes itself off as journalism. We've got to get the resources and funds to build a strong, dynamic, muscular journalism that really covers people in power so we know what they're doing and gives us a full slate of options for how we can proceed as citizens in a free society. We're a million miles from that right now. We're not even in the same time zone or it's the same planet zone. That's where we've got to focus our energy, and that's going to be a political fight. It's going to be a tough fight, but I don't see any other way around it. That's the country, the United States, was founded on a commitment to building an incredibly strong, muscular, independent press system is the foundation of the constitutional system. We're losing that rapidly. If we haven't lost it, we've got to get it back.
And you were making the case earlier for, as you said, public funding of this kind of media. You said it's a tough fight. Are you optimistic? Do you think that could ever happen?
I am optimistic, and for the same reason someone in healthcare would be optimistic, because virtually every other major democratic power in the world has public funding of independent journalism at rates of 10 to 100 times more than the United States, and by what The Economist magazine calls the most democratic nations in the world by all the traditional standards, the freest nations, are the nations that have the largest government public subsidies of journalism, and it's uncensored, independent, adversarial journalism, but a free people establishes it as something necessary to maintain their freedoms.
Bob McChesney, thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
That was Bob McChesney. He's a professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, host of Media Matters at Illinois Public Media. He's got a passel of books out there on various media topics as well. Coming up in our next hour, a look at the fairy tale, how it's changed over the years, what it means to us, how print changed it, how TV and movies have changed the fairy tale. That's coming up. Stay tuned. A lot more to come here. I'm Rob Ferret. I'm filling in for Kathleen Dunn this week. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.